Hello, and welcome to another Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about Volume 9, Issue 1, The End of Empire, The Fall of Rome. Joining me to discuss the topic are regulars Joshua Browers, Lindsay Powell, and Mark McCaffrey. Before we kick off, Joshua, do you want to give us an update on Ancient History Magazine?
Yeah, the issue is coming along nicely. We have quite a variety of different writers, including an article by Mark McCaffrey, who's here in the podcast with us, on the Vigiles. It's about exploration in the ancient world, so it's got stuff on Herodotus, on explorations by the Phoenicians. It has a really great centerfold that I will be blogging about at some point, also made by Johnny Shoemate, about featuring gorillas. I will leave the exact details to the imagination, but it's great fun. It's very pulpy, and yeah, it'll be out soon.
So is that going concern? Are we getting one every two months?
Yeah. So the Kickstarter was, we did the Kickstarter at the beginning of this year, or in the spring, more or less. So it was successfully funded. We got enough money for two issues, and we're just gonna continue with it. It's going to be a going concern, one of the other magazines that we're doing now. So if you haven't subscribed yet and you think it's worth supporting, you should subscribe or make your decision after picking up the first issue if you haven't subscribed yet. It'll appear every 2 months, just like Ancient Warfare, Medieval Warfare, and War Game Soldiers and Strategy. Unlike AW and MW, this is not 60 pages, but 68 pages, because of the scope of the subject matter. We felt it would be better if it was slightly thicker than Ancient Warfare or Medieval Warfare. So 8 extra pages to fill with especially non-theme related stuff, because we want to give people a little bit more breathing room to also cover stuff that's not part of the themed articles. And if you want to learn more, you can go to ancienthistorymagazine.com, which is all a single word, and you'll be able to see the blog posts. Jona Lendering, the editor, and I blog frequently, at least once a week, usually. You can check up on the latest issue. You can download the sample PDF, and you can also have a look at the editorial plan, which is where you'll be able to see the themes for upcoming issues. Issue 2 will be on the reign of Caracalla, for example. Issue 3 on Pergamon. Issue 4 on Egypt before the pyramids. And the other issues are yet to be decided. Issue 5 will probably be mythological Greek. Mm-hmm. I have if you've been following my blog post on Ancient Warfare, you probably have a good idea of what kind of topic specifically we're thinking about. And then there's issue 6, is probably Roman, and issue 7 we've already decided will be on Nineveh, because there will be a big exhibit on Nineveh here in Leiden at the Antiquities Museum. So we're sort of tying in with that and doing an issue on that for the 7th one, which is a year from now, basically. So, yeah.
Cool. So, turning to the topic of this podcast, the fall of Rome, I wonder if we should start by defining what we're calling Rome that fell. I mean, the word fell in itself is problematic. Mm-hmm. What are we calling Rome? My next question would be, when did Rome fall? I mean, what are we putting a pin in for Rome? I mean, they're two. But the title is The Fall of Rome, so what are we calling Rome?
Yeah, we're talking mostly about the Western Roman Empire, which for quite a while didn't even have the capital in the city of Rome at all. So it's at one point in Roman history, the Roman Empire gets divided into a Western and an Eastern half. You see that with Constantine the Great, for example, and also earlier. But it gets divided into Western and Eastern half. And Eastern half basically flourishes more or less. It stays okay in the western half. It gets under pressure more and more from outside forces, barbarians, as the Romans called them, following the Greeks, who are trying to pour into the Roman Empire and basically destabilize it also from within, because the Romans, they hire loads of barbarians to serve in the armies, and the army also barbarizes. But it's a very long process. I mean, the fall of Rome suggests that it's sort of, you know, one day it was there and the next day it was sort of gone because it had fallen somehow, took a tumble. But it's a very long process, and you can actually look at the history of Rome and see that the decay already sets in the later 2nd century AD, during the reign of Marcus Aurelius. Already he was struggling with Germanic peoples trying to flood into Rome, and that caused all sorts of problems already in his day and age, and it just got progressively worse, basically. The fall of Rome, it's very sketchy. It's like with all of this sort of stuff. For the first issue of Ancient History Magazine, I've reviewed Eric Klein's book 1177 BC. And there, 1177 BC is taken as the end of the late Bronze Age, when Bronze Age civilization supposedly collapsed. Again, that is very difficult. That too was a process that took more than just, you know, a single day or a single year or even a few years. And likewise, the fall of Rome was also a drawn-out process, and a date like 1177 BC for Rome, usually that's 476 AD. An exact date is very difficult to pin on this. It's those kinds of dates tend to be conventional, just somebody looking from the outside at the situation and saying, okay, this is the point where we say, as historians, Rome fell. Rome, the Roman Empire didn't exist anymore.
Why is 476 a better full stop than any date that's before or after?
Because that's the last emperor, that's Romulus Augustulus.
In terms of most textbooks, they'll mostly focus on 410 as such, in terms of Rome being embarrassed by being captured and sacked by the Goths as such. It's 476. I think that just emphasizes how much it is just unclear exactly how Rome falls.
Yeah, 410 is the date that the Romans abandoned Britain, for example.
Yeah.
And earlier, I don't remember exactly when they abandoned the Netherlands, for example, the Low Countries, they abandoned the Low Countries. And 410, they abandoned Britain. Basically, the Roman Empire tries to consolidate itself continuously when it's really starting to disintegrate. It just says, okay, let's pull back our armies from Britain and try to shore up the defenses here.
If I could draw a parallel, I think what I would say is it's depending where you stand, you give a different answer. So if you are in Britain, yes, it's 410. If you're in Rome, it may be 476. It might be a lot earlier than that. It might be 440 something. It is really, I think, all a matter of perspective. I'm going to produce this book here, which is Walt Perkins, The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization, which I think is a superb book that covers the subject very, very well indeed. And he really does present the case. It was a catastrophe. It happened very quickly. And some very interesting points raised within that in the archaeology and so forth. But I would imagine if you're in Italy, the experience of the collapse of the West is much later than if you're in other parts of Europe. But even your experience in Britain, for example, is going to be different. One of the things I was in Carwent about 3 or 4 weeks ago, which is almost a complete Roman town, complete with its 3rd and 2nd century AD circuit wall. What's very interesting there is that I think that was either Britannia Secunda, I can't remember quite what its late Roman provincial designation was, but the evidence seems to suggest that it carried on some vestige of Roman lifestyle for some decades on, after supposedly 410. So it really depends on where you are. If you're, for example, in London, it may feel very different because you're much more subject to the whims and the invasions, let's say, of people supposedly coming from the East, and even that's contentious. If you're in the North, it'll be a different experience again. So that would be my contribution. I think it's one answer does not really fit all.
Should we look at some of the pick through the individual factors one by one, and then or some of them, and then try to come to some conclusion afterwards, which how they fit in all together in a juggling match of which is more or less important than any of the others. mean, should we start with the incursions to Rome's borders? I mean, there's always been pressure on Rome's borders. As long as you've got borders, you have skirmishes and pressures. But why towards the end of these become much more of a problem?
Well, on the one hand, you've got the pressures on the borders, you know, migration coming in, you've got threats coming in, but at the same time, it is internal disorder that's happening, you know, simultaneously. You know, you've got rebel emperors rising in the west, you've got the, you know, bickering going on between east and western empires, you've got people striving for, you know, the eunuchs in the court of the west trying to struggle with each other for their own power. Nobody's really managing the situation very well when it comes to what's happening on the borders. And I think there would be a, you know, a certain element of feeling neglected out there by some of the, you know, the provincial troops that are being used in border protection, because at that stage those soldiers are being very, how can I say, they're out there, they're not really in that much contact with a central authority as such. So I think it's the management that sort of lets Rome down.
And I think that's a very good point. Again, taking it to a British example, where you've got the counts of the, is it the Irish shore or the Saxon shore? And I think there's even equivalent up on the sort of northern border of Hadrian's Wall way. There's a suggestion that these have to become much more self-sufficient command structures. They cannot rely really on some sort of central control, a CENTCOM, if you like, directing operations. And in a sense, you couldn't expect it to either, because the command structure is very long at that point. There are lots of grades of officials and so on, and ranks.
And you've got smaller provinces to boot as well.
And that certainly tends to multiply the amount of complexity, bureaucracy, and so on and so forth. But I think also this idea that borders somehow are fixed and like concrete walls, like Berlin walls, if you will, or China, Great Walls of China, they're not, and they never were. They were always permeable. And there were attempts to put, you know, ditches and embankments and the limes, so-called, in place of people. But there's a lot of evidence that suggests that they were not so much limits to stop people coming as to control their access to be able to use them for economic purposes. So it even begs the question that frontiering our understanding, and of course I'm living in a state, Texas, which has a long border which is very contentious, and people keep saying building a wall, and I keep wanting to tell them walls don't work. I've got several from history I could point to you. But anyway, I think that's an important point to remember. You've got, if you like, there are administrative pressures there, there's geographic pressures, and physical ones, which all contribute to this discussion point.
But people were coming in large numbers, and almost when they arrived, would it be fair to say they were regions would become almost un-Romanized? I don't like to use the word. There's all kind of strange connotations with modern migrations of people and language that's easy to drop in, which I don't think is quite correct.
We've been seeing that a lot in the news, of course, with the Syrian refugee crisis, where people were, especially people on the right, are comparing this to the barbarians flooding into the Roman Empire, or the Syrians flooding into Europe. But the situation is completely different, of course. The scale is completely different. The time frame is completely different. It cannot be compared in that particular sense. But the situation that the Romans faced back then, with mass migrations, is what we're talking about. So we're not talking about tens or even hundreds of thousands of refugees. We're talking about just people just moving en masse from one place to another. And those kinds of migrations we've seen before in history, of course, and they're nothing compared to what's happening now in the world. Very different in scale. And of course, the Roman Empire wasn't as smoothly operating as most modern nation states. It was quite a different animal also.
I think the northern frontier of the Roman Empire was always subject to some kind of incursion or migration. And my particular period is the Augustan era. And the one thing that surprises me always is that they were either raids from so-called Germans, with the Celtoi in Dio Cassius typically. But the fact is that they always often used their justification was that, for example, it was the damn Swabi behind us that's causing the Ubii to need to move and migrate. So there always seems to have been somebody after a land grab, and you were the people they were taking the land from, and you had to keep moving. So again, there are lots of historical analogies of, for example, in this country where you've got people, Europeans, you know, going and taking Native Americans' land away, or Saxons taking, you know, Native Celtic people's land. So there had always been, I think, throughout Roman history, a history of migrations, and it goes back to the Cimbri, it goes back to people before that. And what was, I think, remarkable was that between the period, I think, really, the sort of mid-first century and somewhere, I'm going to stick a nail in the hypothetical sand here, around about sometime in the middle of the second century, was how remarkably few they were. So in other words, something had changed within the Romans' ability to do control, I think, on the northern frontier, that stopped these incursions, and then they lost it. It's the 3rd and 4th century, it sort of unravels.
But they're able to manipulate it as well before that. I mean, you are able to, you know, say if you go right to the start of, you know, dealing with the Celts and Germans and whatnot, they turn one against another. They use them as auxiliaries in their armies. They, you know, they manipulate their trade, etc. But when you get to the end of the Roman Empire, you're having, you know, mass migration coming in. You've got no real, you know, consistent policy of how they're going to be dealt with. You've also got a drop in population in the Western Roman Empire as a whole. You've got plague, you've got war, you've got, I think they miss a trick, basically, that earlier in the Roman Empire they would have used the manpower that was coming in. Later in the Roman Empire they're not using the manpower that's coming in. And you've got, you know, the likes of Stilicho, who might be said to sort of be attempting to use it to in a, you know, a sensible way. But of course, I think he's sort of a lone voice in it.
So that would seem to be a contribution, a factor within the fall of the Roman Empire, that alone, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And as regards your earlier point about being pursued, there was, of course, in the 5th century BC, the Huns basically pushing everybody away in front of them. People that were running into the Roman Empire were basically fleeing from the Huns, is the typical story.
But again, that's in the East, they used the Huns. I mean, there are Huns that are, you know, brought into, you know, particular units of the Roman army. So no, there was the possibility of, you know, using these people, but they don't do it consistently.
No, in the Eastern Roman Empire, if I recall correctly, also sort of pushed the Huns away further east, mm-hmm. further west, thinking, you know...
Yeah, sorry, it's the Western... empire that they have a Hun civil guard, I think, in Ravenna, I think.
So what is the difference then? The Eastern Roman Empire, which eventually becomes the so-called Byzantine Empire, is it because they maintain a central control as opposed to the other side of the world, which does not, which is really the key difference?
They focus their control, really. They decide where they're going to focus their attention, because really Greece... they use a sort of, you know, a borderland to sort of keep the West in check. And also, if they need to sort of push off any barbarian trouble, that's, you know, that's the direction to do it. Then they maintain the eastern areas in their control and maintain a firm grip of that, I think.
Which actually seems to be a very sort of Augustan policy, if you might allow me to say so. You know, the people tend to think about the Roman Empire as being just Roman territory. It wasn't. It was this very elaborate patchwork also of we call them client states or client kings, but they were, you know, Sogi allies. They were sort of people that Rome had various degrees of treaties with and obligations to, and they in reverse had obligations back. And it seemed to work for a large number of years.
Until you get to this period when you all of a sudden, you know, the Federati, you've got one mass slaughter of, I think it's in the tens of thousands at one stage, because they feel that they might be going over to the other side, you know, on a whim, possibly. But it's, they're not using them. They're not treating them with the respect. And it's going back to, you know, the Rome of the late Republican era of, you know, the Italian allies wanting to be part of the Roman Republic and, you know, willing to fight for that right. The Vandals and the Visigoths are really in the same boat, and yet they keep getting repulsed, whereas I think that was Rome's lifeline.
And we keep referring this to incursions and migrations. Were they incursions and migrations, or you know, which is the most? Were they people wanting to come in an imperialistic, put their flag in and say this is ours, or were they wanted to come in and be part of the empire?
Alaric and the Goths seem to be wanting to be part of the empire, but sort of to have their own little sort of state within the empire at the same time, I think.
Yeah, weren't they actually converted Christians or something? They actually wanted to go to Rome for religious reasons, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought so. They seem to be very amenable to whatever Rome wants them to be. In terms of, I think there's one reference also to them sort of saying yes, if we need to be pagans as well. It's the administration that are sort of going back and forth over issues. One moment they're sort of saying yes, we're going to, we're getting rid of all the pagan old beliefs and whatnot, we're going totally Christian. And then, of course, when you get the Goths really putting pressure on them, they're sort of saying, oh, actually, we don't need to be. But then all of a sudden, yes, oh, no, we're going to be dead certain Christians again. And therefore, we're going to punish everybody who hasn't or has erred, even though we've erred as well. But it's inconsistencies.
Yeah, the other thing I heard was the Vandalic people, didn't they? In a sense, they used the Roman Empire as a transit camp to get to Africa. So, they knew that they had to get somewhere else, and they decided that they'd take North Africa as their particular territory. And the Franks, of course, ended up in what used to be the Gallic region.
Oh, if you know anything about the Roman Empire at that stage, then I think they're very sensible to sort of say, yes, that's what Rome depends upon, North Africa. They're grown at that stage, so I think if you've got anybody who's a strategician in there, then go for it.
Was there any central control that actually came up with something like that, or was it all just happenstance
like earlier in the imperial period when you've got barbarians being brought into the Roman army? These guys seem to have a fair bit of knowledge about the Roman army themselves, being brought in and used as allied commanders. They know what's what and what. About Rome and its tactics and its supply routes and everything. In some cases, Alaric proves that he knows more about some of the routes through Italy than some of the Roman commanders.
And that's a very good point, because I think one of the things, and it was made, I think one of the Monty Python crew did a really, I think, quite interesting documentary about the barbarians, is the fact that our understanding of these people, and in fact the very word we use to describe them called barbarians, is a sort of a classic Mediterranean view of these people. And it comes with a whole lot of baggage. I mean, these people actually turned out had cultures of their own. Obviously, they had sort of intellectual life as well. I mean, some of these leaders, the duques, as the Romans were called, were actually quite clever. I mean, they were quite good strategists, organizers, and so forth. I mean, this was not a rabble in a lot of these cases. And I think that it's very easy to slip into the Roman sort of perspective of these things, when in fact, when you look at their sort of material civilization, it's quite surprising what they're doing. And the parallel is in the same way the Celts. I mean, we tend to look, the Celts are barbarians. Well, when you look at Celtic art, it's astonishing stuff. Some of their lore and the tradition and the L-O-R-E as opposed to L-A-W, very sophisticated, and I think the same thing can be made of the so-called barbarian people.
Well, the term barbarian, of course, is derived from the Greek barbaros, and that simply means people who speak barbar languages. In other words, people who speak a foreign language. There's nothing. To the Greeks, the Romans were barbarians because they spoke this unintelligible gibberish, basically. So there was originally, at least, no. Barbarians didn't have a pejorative meaning at all. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, this, clad in animal skins. I mean, Thucydides, when he describes the people of Acarnania, I think, in his history of the Peloponnesian War, he says that they are primitive peoples because they wear animal skins and they eat raw meat and that sort of stuff. That's primitives. But barbarians, as such, were just people who spoke another language. And it's only later that barbarians get the pejorative meaning, where they're also uncivilized, basically. It's the distinction between barbarism and civilization, which especially in the 19th century, under influence of colonialism.
And to take the origin of the word civilization, which effectively means a sort of citizen in an urban environment, I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that what these so-called barbarians were actually doing was moving into Roman settlements and actually giving them a new lease of life. In fact, they were repurposing buildings and reusing materials and so on and so forth. So I think these people knew a good thing when they saw it, and they were actually very inventive. I think, you know, if we look at barbarians in the sense more of refugees rather than as people who have a sort of like a mission to destroy, and you see them as a refugee mentality, that I think informs a different perspective. These people are out to survive and make anew and rebuild and so forth.
Rome had always been a melting pot, though, so why did they not sort of civilize and fall into step with you know, the grand Roman ideal?
Probably because there was nothing to offer as such. They were already on a comparative level, a comparable level to the Romans, so there was very little that the Romans could offer them. I mean, Roman citizenship was essentially meaningless at that point, I think, because everybody had already become a Roman citizen or was relatively easy to become a Roman citizen. So there was no real... It wasn't like in the early Roman Empire where, you know, the empire really was something impressive that you hadn't seen before. I mean, this is in a world where probably everybody already knew the Roman Empire or had family living in the Roman Empire or had served in the army of the Roman Empire, or and also their own societies were similar in such a way.
I think the opulence of some of the provincial cities, I mean, which are now some of Europe's great cities, I'm thinking of Trier and Lyon and then many of the cities in France and obviously Italy, I mean, Ravenna being a case in point, you didn't have to go to Rome to see the best of it. It was actually quite local.
I was going to say, at the same time, Rome is sort of going through this, you know, crisis of identity stage in terms of the new national identity of being Christian sort of gradually coming in. And, of course, with that coming in, you've also got a bit of difference in terms of administration, because they start turning to the emerging church as possibly an avenue for carrying out civil administration. So all of a sudden there's this... You know, are we joining into the Rome that was, or is Rome, you know, on the cusp of actually waiting for something to take over it?
Yeah, and the Church of Rome, I suppose, as you might call it, knew it had power, and it would force the emperor to bow before it. I mean, it really understood that it had an immense reach into society and ability to get things done, whereas the emperor actually, at this point, didn't have those abilities.
I mean, how much of a divisive factor was religion? By this point, tribes of the barbarians were already Christian. The empire was...
Yeah, but as soon as you get Christian, the term Christian coming in, it's not very long before you start getting schism between Christians in terms of, you know, who's what type of Christian. There's Arians running around. Are we talking about the Eastern Christians in line with the Eastern Empire? Are we talking about the Western Church? Are we talking about it being, you know, the plaything of certain people like, you know, Bishop Ambrose in the Western provinces, really, you know, carving out his domain that he's going to be influential over. It really sort of, if Rome had problems before Christianity in terms of, you know, emperors or, you know, rival potential emperors, you know, coming into the fray, when you get Christianity thrown into it, all of a sudden there's this another dimension of schism just everywhere in the Roman Empire administration.
Everybody wants to have God on their side, don't they? And it can be the one who claims that you are the one with God on your side. The other guy clearly is the loser. I find an interesting parallel. So, for example, in the earlier Roman period, the Principate, the early empire, there was an understanding of the Pax Deorum, which was this, if you like, this alliance between people on earth and the gods, which is to say that there were things, traditions and customs and ceremonies and offerings that you gave the gods and they would look out for the state. The difference with the Christian perspective on this was that really it was a different kind of God. First of all, there was only one of them, and there was a different sort of message that went with it. So it wasn't a transactional arrangement anymore, that you do this for me and the God will be rewarded with an altar or a temple, which is why Rome was so filled with temples, of course, many of which fell down because there wasn't the money to keep them going. But the Christian church had a different kind of God. I mean, you had to live your life now by a set of rules, which included a role for the church in it, you know, and I think that completely fundamentally changed the relationship of people with the state.
I have a note that I'm not completely sure I've pulled it from, that Gibbon puts religion center stage and that he suggested Christianity brought better moral standards, so less sex, fewer children, which meant fewer legionaries. I'm not sure whether I got that and wrote that in, or if I've pulled that from somewhere when I was reading up.
I just wrote something for the review that I did for 1177 BC. Is that writers who write about big cataclysmic events like the end of the Bronze Age or the fall of the Western Roman Empire, it tends to be a bit apocalyptic, and they tend to read into it what they themselves are obsessed about. And Edward Gibbon in the 18th century, a child of the Enlightenment, of course, when he had to find the cause for, you know, what caused the downfall of the Roman Empire, obviously it had to be religion in his eyes. That idea is no longer seriously maintained, as far as I know. There is nobody who would seriously say that the Romans lost the empire because they converted to Christianity, partially because of the reasons already mentioned, that Christianity wasn't as simple as is sometimes said. But it's simply an idea that was born in the Enlightenment, that simply Gibbon reading into Roman history what he himself believes, and it's something that you see time and time again in books written about the end of civilizations, which always have this sort of dramatic thing that if we're not careful, this is going to happen to us. In my review of Klein's book, for example, I also point out that Klein's book basically is an updated version of Robert Drews's book on the end of the Late Bronze Age. I forget the exact title. It's the end of the Bronze Age, changes in warfare and the catastrophe 1200 BC, I think. But he sums up all the causes, and then he says, but of course it's, you know, new types of warfare that ultimately changed everything, because that book was written in the early 90s when the Americans were suffering from troubles in Somalia, Mogadishu, when they went to Iraq for the first time under Bush Senior. So obviously it had to be this military thing was the cause. And when you read Klein's book, he lists all the causes, and a lot of those, you know, if you read them, and also he makes frequent comparisons with modern situations, it's all stuff that seems to be ripped from the headlines. It was originally something I put in a review. I removed it because I thought I was being unkind, and I really like his book, so it's not a problem. But, you know, it's climate change, and it's refugees pouring into your country, and it's droughts and famines and plagues, and it's all sorts. It's almost biblical in its aspect of what it all sums up. And he finally ends up and says, okay, it's probably systems collapse is the thing. And that's what a lot of people also suggest for the Western Roman Empire, that it's not just a single cause. It's not just Christianity that caused it. And I don't think Christianity can at all be blamed in that regard.
You don't think it's declining moral standards? They're all just having too much sex, too much wine, can't be bothered anymore?
No, well, that would be under paganism, right? I mean, in under Christianity, the only time you have sex is if you want to procreate. So it's
actually,
and already Augustus had rules that tried to stimulate procreation. So I mean, you don't have to be Christian.
Yosha's right. I think, I mean, historians do come with an agenda, and unfortunately, sometimes it's not always clear what that is, and sometimes it's very opaque. But sometimes they have the germ of some kind of truth. And to my earlier point, I think, though, that Christianity, I don't think, was the cause of the fall of the Roman Empire, much as Gore Vidal was very strong on the opinion that it did. But I think what it did do, it changed, like I said earlier, the relationship between the individual and his obligations to the state. In other words, that the church, in a sense, became, it inserted itself in the way of the relationship between the man and his God. So whereas before you'd have a lararium and you'd have all these little things in your house, and you would, you know, you'd appease the ancestors and the household genii and so on and so forth, now you went to a church and a sort of priest would sort of interface between you and God, and it would sort of, in a sense, make you more a subservient player as opposed to an active participant, I think. That's kind of my perspective on that.
Yeah, one of the big differences between the Christian faith and paganism is that in paganism, priests basically play not much of a big role. I mean, priests are there to make sure that everything goes according to plan, and they slaughter the animal and that sort of stuff in original Greek and Roman religion. But basically religion is part of the entire community. It takes place outside, around the altar. The temple is just where the statue of the god is housed, and just priests go in there basically just once a year. The doors are open, that sort of stuff. And with what the church does, of course, the Christian church, is they say, okay, no, it's the temple is the house of God, but we're going to put the altar inside, and everybody is welcome inside. And then the priest sort of serves as a host, leading the mass and everything else. And like you said, sort of being the bridge between the people gathered and God above. So that is very different. But I don't think it would have had a very big effect on how the Romans... I don't think the Romans would have... actually, let's say this. I don't think the Romans would have felt constrained or anything by their switch from paganism to Christianity. I don't think the impact in that regard... I think the choice, the first Christian emperor, Constantine, became Christian, of course, for... not because he was incredibly pious, but because it served him for some purpose.
Well, it allowed him to get more troops, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Appealing to a different group. So
he was a politician. Yeah. He knew the value of symbols and so forth. Yeah. And I agree with you. I'm not necessarily saying that it was a primary cause. I think it's a factor because, intriguingly, a lot of the Res Publica, the organization and the structure of the Res Publica, found its way into the Church of Rome. Its structures and its diocese and its priests and all the, you know, and of course the Pontifex Maximus. So interestingly enough, the Pontiff, who's here in the States right now, of course the chief priest. That's not to say that, you know, that there was sort of pagan thing that surrounded him, but his importance as a figurehead, I think, was crucial in there. And I think what it also does, it maintains structure. The one thing that is very evident in Roman society is it has this political and religious structure. There are all these colleges and there's all these offices and magistrates and so forth, and that carries on. It's just the names change.
Mm-hmm. But it is a big change in personnel as well, because at that point in time, you're going away from all the traditional families. I mean, okay, there's not as much tradition as there was back in the Republic, but still, you're going to, in one sweep, say, right, we're switching from the traditional families of Rome, bringing in all new personnel, and it may be fulfilling the same sort of purpose, and just under slightly different name. But it is a break with the administration of the past, a very clear break.
I think part of the problem was that they introduced a lot more administration, which actually made things worse. If you think the sort of the empire that Augustus so-called ruled was a tiny administration. I mean, it's extraordinary how it even worked at all when you think about it. It was a kind of a sleight of hand with indirect rule, really. As long as everybody kind of believed it, it kind of worked. But by the time you get to the 4th and 5th centuries, you have this extraordinary bureaucracy and administration that would part church, part sort of government, which I think, in a sense, is part of the sclerosis that breaks the empire from being able to respond to crises.
And you also get worming its way in between there. You've got the rise of the eunuchs, really, at this stage in history as well. It all of a sudden becomes a popular thing to do. Don't be one of the guys going for ultimate power. Be one of these guys who sort of worms your way into the court politics and manipulates from behind the scene.
Okay. Yeah, if you look at the long history of the Roman Empire, you can see that it seems to become more centralized, so that they try to, that the emperor in particular tries to get more and more power consolidated around his own figure. And I think that's probably fair to say, especially for the later Roman Empire. Also, when you get the dominate and that sort of stuff, replacing the principate, you really see this sort of clutching at power and making sure that everything is vested in yourself. And that too might explain the move from a polytheistic religion to a monotheistic religion. Everything neat and ordered and vested in a single person, for example.
Had the empire become too obsessed with its own politics to actually look beyond itself?
Rome itself had. I wouldn't say the empire.
Well, my view is, I think that the one thing that marks the Romans out is that they were always obsessed by their politics. To be Rome was essentially to be a political animal, to be a participant in the Res Publica, and it was replicated right throughout their provinces too. I mean, the local ordo and the magistrates in the towns and cities that were little microcosms of the Republic. I think that the difference is when you get to the later centuries, is it becomes more rigid. So there's less free discussion. There's less of the so-called contio, where the Masoret talks to his people like a sort of a hustings, if you like. It's much more, I think, directed, and it's orders from the chief, and this is what you're going to do. And I said that's why I use the word sclerosis. I think there's an inertia which builds in as a result of that. It's more like a communist party rather than a group of enthusiasts, which is what it started.
So it loses its dynamism.
I really think so.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Had economics changed in any way? I mean, the empire, it just stopped expanding, and expansion is always good for economics. You know, continual wars and expansion brings in cash. Had the economic situation changed against the empire?
Well, that goes back to, if you believe the old adage that, you know, you're going to have to need the taxes to pay the troops to conquer the land to raise the taxes, and if the triangle breaks in the end, then that's the system blown. And of course, as Rome gets to this stage, you're having to, you know, increase the taxes because you can't actually do as much in terms of the external conquering as once, you know, could be done. There's a bit of a, how can I say, cash flow problem, really. And of course, that sort of starts bringing down the troop numbers and whatnot, pulling back troops from different areas of the empire. It can be explained in that way, I think, but it is a simplistic view of it.
I think that there is an economic angle to this case. I mean, famously, the Diocletian's edict on prices and salaries and wages and so forth. Inflation was clearly running away of things. They'd had to rebase the coinage several times. I remember having a discussion on Facebook with somebody with, you know, the denarius was a thing of long past. You know, it was the solidus and all sorts of strange currencies. And I argued that you get these huge big hoards in Britain, particularly in even, I think, northern France. They're not worth very much. I mean, there are hundreds, even thousands of these coins which are silvered bronze, which I don't think bought you very much, but you had to have a big pot full to be able to do anything with it.
But that goes right the way back to Nero's time, when he started debasing the currency at that point. So,
well, the rot sets in, and of course, at the end of the day, money in banking is about confidence. Hmm. And once it starts, it's very hard to get that confidence back, as we are still living with in our own time. So I think there's an economic component about this too. And Yosha said earlier about the fact that we the distinction between non-Roman and Roman is basically non-existent at this point. So everybody has to be treated pretty much the same. And of course, you've got this huge bureaucracy which expects to be paid. And I would guess you mentioned earlier about the fact there was famine, and I think there was a population collapse.
Plague as well, and yeah. Mm.
So, you know, it's a pretty awful nexus of all these bad things happening. A lot fewer people carrying the burden of running a nation state and all the rest of it to move forward.
The final facts that we've not covered on my list is the military, the failure of the military. And how had all this migration affected the legions? I mean, they've clearly not been able to plug the gaps and stop them coming in or do anything about them or control it.
Well, this wasn't the army of the first or second century anymore. This was a different kind of army. I think it's what they call the new mobile armies. I mean, the idea that somehow they are sort of, you know, square, rectangular, shield-bearing metal helmets and the rest, it's moved on from there. You have a much stronger, I think, emphasis on cavalry and mobility, people being embedded with cities. There's a lot more emphasis on militias and this type of thing. Cities are walled and increasingly investing a lot of their wealth in putting stone walls around each other. So I think the focus has become a lot more local, as opposed to what we were talking about earlier about these nominal borders, you know, sort of the regional frontiers of Germania Superior, Inferior, Mesia, and so forth. And that factors back into the cost. I mean, all this has to be paid for somehow.
And presumably walls means that cities are not happy that central government can actually protect them, so they're having to protect themselves. So they're seeing the collapse happen.
Basically, you have two types of states, if you want to use some sort of typology. You've got city states and you've got territorial states. And a territorial state is one that can control its borders, and there is no need to fortify individual cities, unlike a city state where you fortify a city because the enemy is just across the border. So, for example, if you look at classical Greece, it's all city states, so they tend to fortify their little cities. If you look at Egypt in its heyday, they just fortify, you know, the borders, and they put border posts and outposts and whatever. They don't go and fortify major cities most of the time. And so what you see in Rome in during the course of the 3rd, 4th, and especially the 5th century is that cities start building new walls. Also in Rome, they start rebuilding walls. And that's clearly a sign where the people living in those cities have lost their faith in the wider state being able to protect them in case of an emergency. And that's, of course, perfectly valid because the army of the later Roman army becomes a lot leaner in the sense that it there's fewer people in there. And they split up the army into much smaller pieces. They already mentioned the vexillae, if the word is correct. Vexillum, singular. They become sort of like these flying squads that if there's a fire to be put out somewhere, they send these small armies out. But those are not really built for fighting big numbers of people that come across the borders or anything, or the Huns or whatever. So that's you see them sort of scrambling, trying to put the smaller armies together to form bigger armies to fight bigger enemies. But it seems like the system is sort of broken down by then.
And to sort of dig into the archaeology for a second, it's interesting when you look at something like Hauster's Roman fort on Hadrian's Wall, where its Hadrianic structure has completely changed. So within that playing card shape, what used to be the barracks where, you know, individual units would sort of house their tent parties and so forth, for cavalry or infantry unit, had always had the population. The civilian population always lived on the outside. Well, by these days, the 3rd and 4th century, the families are living inside with the troops. And these barrack buildings have become little houses, and they're completely unrecognizable from what was Hadrian's original plan. So I think what that feeds into what you said, Yosha, which is that people don't feel quite so secure anymore. You can't risk being on the outside of a wall. You've got to be on the inside. And the one thing that impressed me greatly about Carwent is a small town. I mean, it's maybe a couple of dozen hectares or so. But the walls are magnificent. I mean, it represents a major investment by its community. They stand quite high. I think maybe about six. What was it now? I'm going to guess about 4 meters maximum, maybe at the high point where they survive. And they've got these wonderful octagonal towers which are bolted on there. I mean, this is an aspirational city. If it's going to spend its money on a wall, it's going to build a damn good one. And what's fascinating to me is down the road they've supposedly got Caerleon, or what's left of Caerleon, with its fort. So clearly they're not going to get much support from those people. And then down the coast of Wales, you've got Cardiff and you've got Barry and all these other places all the way up to Carmarthen. And there's this general sense you get of you're kind of on your own now. You look after yourself.
And you've got the port defences right around Britain at that time as well. I mean, that's sort of saying that Britain is really on the defensive all that period. You've got incursions being made from every which direction, and you've got trade, or what trade is going across the channel. It seems to be being shepherded across the channel by fleets as well.
And yet you hear that they're actually at the same time the Romans are also allowing certain people in as paid mercenary. And it's this sort of interesting judgment call they have to make. I'm going to pick you because I trust you. The other guy, you're the enemy. You have to stay out. And I wonder whether they always make the right call.
Do we know what number, how many, you know, the numbers of taking any extra mercenaries to plug the gaps? Was it enough to, you know, to tip the balance, to change the culture of the armed forces themselves?
Oh, numbers in the ancient world.
In short, no.
No. It's always a guess. And most people's guesses are as good or as bad as they come along, I think.
But to put it in context, for example, I go back to my Augustus model. I mean, there was an army of about, 300,000 people, maximum maybe, that kind of number, in a population of how many in the empire? A few millions. It was always a small army. It's amazing it did what it did with so few resources. And I think it's because they made strategic decisions as where they put those resources, which made the difference. And the difference between the Augustan period and, for example, the end of the Roman Empire is those resources are in different places and maybe not as effective. Because, like you said, Yosho, they're leaner, but they're not. The other side, the flip side of leanness is, if you like, not having it in strength. You don't have the bulk to go with it.
They're trying to fill the gaps on the borders, really, aren't they? I mean, with having more mobile troops, they're basically admitting we can't defend our own borders. We can't manage it. We're going to put small groups in, you know, very random positions, and in a lot of it leave it up to the locals to actually, you know, do their defending. And it shows when it gets to the end of Roman Britain as such, when you get the troops actually, or the official legions having gone, you then get a very long sort of tail end of Roman Britain where the locals are actually doing a better job of organising a defence against the incursions that are being made than when they were officially under Roman control.
Well, and that's very interesting. The British model is interesting because it had been divided into, was it four provinces and I think dioceses?
Four, maybe five at that stage.
Yeah, and that's why I said, one book I read recently, which makes this case for the fact that the sort of bit, which is effectively mid and south Wales, sort of lingered a lot longer because, in a sense, it was away from the main eastern incursions from Saxons and Angles. And, you know, it sort of had a destiny of its own.
But you got enough coming over the Irish Sea at that time as well from the Scots coming across and the Atticotti as well. So, I mean, it's not a peaceful area even on that. Anywhere you go around Britain,
But I think it comes back to this idea of what we were talking about, the fall of Rome and what that meant was, it's the idea, what did people think of themselves as being? So, I can't really answer my own question having posited it, but it's clear that, for example, the people in Byzantium always thought of themselves as Romans, Romios. Even now Greeks call themselves Romios. But I wonder whether, if you were to ask, for example, someone in Carwent, went to Salurum, for example, in, I'm going to pick, 476, for example, are you Roman? He's probably going to say yes. 100 years later, is there even a man standing in Carwent? I don't know.
They might be saying that they're Roman, but their identity as Roman or their idea of what it is to be a Roman might be more at that stage as a resistance to something else as an alternative, rather than identifying necessarily with, you know, we are part of those guys who, you know, live in that glorified city of Rome, which is no longer glorified.
We get into that marvellous territory of Arthur of the Britons.
Yes, I know, sorry.
Which is another podcast, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, well, how much did it actually change for the man in the street after, you know, 476? You know, I don't suppose on the whole, it's not as if there was a light went off. He'd just carry on ploughing his field and tilling his land and doing his thing.
Well, I think this is where Brian Ward Perkins' book comes in very useful on those sorts of points, because he looks at the archaeology, and again, it comes back to where you are. In some communities, it was devastating. I mean, the material circumstances of people collapsed. I mean, the pottery went from being high-quality pottery to, frankly, awful stuff. But then you've got other places like, you know, famous Webster's Wroxeter, where they're rebuilding the bathhouse and they're repurposing into something else, and other buildings which once upon a time had, you know, tiled roofs, now have wattle and daub and thatch. So people are doing different things with the spaces and the materials that we have, you know, from those days. And, does that make them worse or better? I mean, it really comes down to, I guess, the person's experience at that time. Someone living in 476 didn't know what Augustan Rome looked like, or even the Rome of 100 years before. They didn't know.
I mean, trade would have petered out rather than disappeared. You know, the roads would have got worse and more troublesome rather than just go. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, the stick maker, whose, you know, jobs slowly went away as people stopped using sticks. These jobs must have disappeared rather than a boom.
And I think that's true, but again, depending on where you are, certain communities are able, amazingly, to maintain long-distance trade. Maybe the focus of that trade changes. So, for example, maybe in Wales they start looking to Ireland instead of looking east to other parts of the country. Or maybe the interchanges are now with northern France as opposed to, for example, Spain or somewhere. So I think the archaeology gives us a very, very mixed picture. So it wasn't the same experience all over the place. And that's in part because the different invading peoples, if you were, brought with them different views of things. And the way they were responded to and reacted to, of course, also differed.
And it's also about how much the troop movements at the end of the Roman Empire affected as well. Where are the troops being taken from the most as such? Where is the Romanization being reversed?
So we've talked right around all the factors. Any one factor bigger than any others? I mean, it would seem to be every one of them is as important as the rest. But is there any one, if you took it away, you know, the whole lot might have just kept petering on a bit longer?
Well, I think this invasion of peoples has to be a major piece. I mean, it sort of stands out as being these foreign peoples bringing their barbarian ways must be a big part of the fall.
It's the most visible thing. It's the same as with the end of the Bronze Age again. Sorry to keep bringing that up. Where you have the sea peoples attacking Egypt, and there is clear evidence for movement of people and cities being smashed and raided and smashed and sacked and whatever. So yeah, of course that is a big factor. But you know, other stuff that we already mentioned, the fact that this slow disintegration of the Western Roman Empire, at least, already. Can already be noticed during the reign of Marcus Aurelius, that it's a process that takes place over a long time, plague feeding into that. There might have been other problems with obtaining particular resources, for example, for the Bronze Age. Again, evidence points that tin was difficult to acquire, and similar stuff also happened with the Roman Empire. So there's this whole amount of different factors, and of course the main factor, if you point at mass migrations and say, okay, this is the cause that caused the downfall of Rome, the question that's sort of is leaving that unanswered is, why did these people move?
On the one hand, I think I'd hate to get away from the fact that in these days it's more the trend to sort of look at, you know, something like social migration and the idea that there's a bigger picture that you should be taken back to. But I do like the idea that sort of these days seems a bit old, but saying that actually I would say there's a lot of responsibility on some individuals here, and that there, if, you know, be it in terms of decisions over migrating peoples, whether it's decisions over the handling of religious issues and whatnot, I think that there is the capacity there for some certain individuals, you know, should a different decision have been made here or there, the whole situation could have been turned around.
Mm-hmm. I'm just reading a paragraph here for the War Perkins book where he basically makes a point. For example, by the time the last Roman emperor disappeared, it was kind of shrug of the shoulders. Oh, there was still a Roman emperor? Yeah. You know, if it had got as bad as that, so nobody's really in command anymore.
Now, the last Roman Empire, Romulus Augustulus, was basically a boy who was put on the throne simply because his father wanted a puppet figure there, if I recall correctly. Mm. And he didn't have any actual power. And also his abdication was basically a bit of a farce. By that time it didn't mean anything. But Rome also, by the time that Rome fell, Rome was no longer the capital of the Roman Empire, as far as I know. The Western Roman Empire was Ravenna, if I recall correctly.
No, but if we come back to, you know, somebody like Theodoric or someone that, you know, like he tries to sort of set up, a, you know, an inheritance for his sons and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the structure that he leaves, there's such a reliance on Stilicho. It depends on how he handles it, how he sort of, whether he's going for, you know, ultimate power, is he trying to be the power behind the throne? How does Ulrich, respond to his dealings with the Roman Empire and all of the different bureaucracy that comes with it? There are individuals there that I still do argue that if they would have taken a different tact, or, you know, if, say, the Goths would have been, you know, recruited into the Roman army in, you know, a purposeful way, then you could have had a longer lasting, a revival maybe, of the Roman Empire in the West, rather than a decline and death.
Yeah. Was it a failure to assimilate all these people coming in? Surely there's always been influxes of people, but latterly there was it too many people, or just a failure to of the idea of Rome to assimilate these people into it, or sell them that idea?
Not to quote George Bush, but, you know, you're either with us or you're against us.
Yeah.
So, and these guys were back and forth over the issues just so many times. And in the end, they were more pushed out rather than them deciding, you know, we don't, you know, we've got any, you know, even a religious or a, you know, a cultural, you know, grudge against Rome as such. It's more the fact that you won't let us into the club that actually ends up turning them against Rome. And I think it's the same sort of thing if you switch back to Roman Britain, there is over the last, maybe even 100 years of Roman Britain, the emphasis is keep them out, build up the defences, you know, make sure that we're making that identity of barbarians and Roman citizens, very clear. It's not really using, you know, being political about the whole thing, or actually, you know, utilising them like once had done, had been done in Augustan Rome, for example.
I wonder if there's an interesting parallel here, sort of modern. Bear with me, I try and explain it. So, for example, once upon a time there was the DDR, the Deutsche Demokratische Republik, which had a wall, by the way, right down the middle of it, to try and keep those Western people out. So they were all self-contained, and they had a very bureaucratic state and the secret police, the Stasi, and all those terrible things. But what was interesting is that at a certain point, and in very short order, it disappeared. And it's trying to understand what was it. It was a bloodless coup, but it was catastrophic. And what came out of it was a different country. And it's not like it was a, I don't know whether it was a slow process, to take Yosha's point, and you could argue, yes, it decayed from within. But on the other hand, the speed at which it came is like people decided they didn't want this anymore. They did not want to be part of DDR anymore. And I wonder, there, to draw my analogy back to the Roman Empire, there were certain communities which had become disillusioned with it. They were expected, I think someone said earlier, to manage affairs by themselves. So why are we even part of this anymore, guys? We're paying for something that doesn't help us. So we're not going to be fighting.
The fall of the Soviet Union is quite different from the fall of the Roman Empire, not in the least that it took place in the modern age. And in the modern age, everything tends to go a bit more quickly than... back in the past. So, the fall of the Soviet Union is an interesting case. I mean, I would argue the point that it is a part of a process with appeasement and with moving on, but also to sort of tie in with Mark's point about individuals. It was Gorbachev, eventually, of course, who made certain decisions that paved the way for the fall of the Berlin Wall. But I don't think those are can be compared in such a way, the fall of the Soviet Union with the fall of the Western Roman Empire.
I was talking about DDR, particular case. But so if we looked at the Roman example, I mean, and we sort of tried to find an individual, I'm going to be controversial and say I blame Marcus Aurelius, because he made a really bad decision in choosing his son to be the emperor. If he'd have chosen someone else, it would have been better, but he made a really bad decision.
There would have been a bad emperor eventually. If it wasn't Commodus, it would have been somebody else.
But what was very interesting is that there was a moment in the so-called five emperors where Hadrian had that brilliant insight, why don't I pick two generations? So, I think it was Antoninus Pius and Lucius Verus. It was very interesting. He thought it all out. And if there were more people like him who could conceptualize
Constantine does the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
Constantine tries to do the same thing again, and again it sort of ends up breaking apart. The plans go astray because of who he chooses, because of who comes next after them, etc.
So I wonder whether it comes down to this then, really, that the fundamental issue here was that Rome effectively was a monarchy by any kind of real definition. And it just takes one man to make a bad decision and think and unravel. What it needed was a different system. It needed a different kind of government system. I don't know whether it would have to be more democratic, the more people actually had more voice and more say in it, so it was actually more of a stakeholder-type political system, or what. I've never thought of it in those terms before, but what they were trying to make was a world which Augustus had set up in the wake of supposedly the collapse of the old republican system. And amazingly, it had worked for something like three centuries, and it had run its course. It needed a different model, and they couldn't work out what that model was. And in
you've
the end, it was
a lot of government systems going around at that stage in time as well. I mean, you've got the emperor in the west, you've got the emperor in the east, you've got the senate in the west, you've got the senate in the east, you've got eunuchs going around, mixing between both courts. And then just to mix it up, you've got the church deciding that they're going to actually play their hand in politics at the same time in their different ways and in their different sects.
And in some way, it did survive, of course. The Byzantine Empire stood until 1453.
Hmm.
So, in some sense, it was successful if you can draw the line from Rome, the rise of Roman Republic, and then the Roman Empire. And the Byzantine Empire basically becomes the inheritance of the inheritors of the Roman tradition. I mean, they like Lindsay already said, they refer to themselves as Romans. They didn't refer to themselves as Byzantines. They refer to themselves as Romans. So from their point of view, if you adopt an emic point of view, as they say, instead of etic, which is externally observed instead of internally perceived. The Romans continued to exist, and they also tried to reconquer Italy and Rome and part of the western provinces. So in some sense, Rome never really fell in 476 AD, or whenever you want to point, whenever you want to put the date, they got rid of some provinces, and then later they tried to reconquer them. They were, to a larger or bigger extent, successful, if you want to put it like that.
So essentially, the reason why they actually survived was that the West declined.
Yeah,
you know, one declines and then the next rises, and yeah.
But some would say, of course, it reemerged under the Treaty of Rome and is now the European Union.
Should we leave things there? I'd like to thank Joshua, Lindsay and Mark. For more information on the magazine, go to ancientwarfare.com. For more history podcasts, go to thehistorynetwork.org. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.